It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
Well, we're recording early again because I'm off to Australia.
Yeah, you're quite the traveler.
Yeah, but this will be airing on. I'm getting ready to go home. I'm getting ready to come home when Bud is on.
Well, how was your trip?
I think it's good. Some of the venues, it's kind of getting awkward because some of the venues have packed out and, you know, people are going to have it in their home and, you know, 20, 30 people, and it ends up being more than that. So they get a venue.
Why is that awkward?
It's just awkward for them because they're going to host something in their home. Next thing, you're having to rent a center, a community center, and then, you know, just, I liked it better when house-sized groups could get together and do some yakking, but I've not been to any of these places I'm going to before, so there's just a whole lot of people that we had no idea how many folks were there, so we'll figure that out.
But when you break them into groups of three or four, it becomes the same conversations. You just need comfortable chairs.
No, I'm always standing when it's big, but I don't know about that. But anyway, so you have a good weekend.
I got fried up at a soccer tournament.
Ooh.
It was too much sun, and we forgot the
sunscreen.
It was overcast when we left.
And hat.
I had all that, but I got the Rudolph nose.
I see that.
Yeah.
You shut out all the lights, and I can still read my notes.
We did the soccer deal. I won't get off on this rant, but I got to tell you, angry coaches.
Sounds like you're getting off on
they
this.
Should,
rant.
They should. Well, I could go someplace.
No, we're not going to name names, hopefully.
No, I don't even. I just realized it was a little microcosm into, I think, a little bit of sometimes the weird side of the church world. One of the girls had gotten yelled at by the coach later after the game, and the girls won both games, and yet they were kind of down because they sort of felt like
the whole team got yelled at?
Seemingly.
Pretty much, okay.
And so they sort of felt like they were in trouble, and you're just going like, they did great. And so as the parents, we're all just like, we're totally confused here. What's wrong with this young man? And one of the girls is explaining to the other, well, he yells at us because he cares. And
this wasn't the man's daughter, was it?
No.
Wow.
But I sat there and I just kind of went, okay, that is a recipe for a lifetime of abuse if that's the lens. I mean, and she's just saying it trying to somehow feel okay in her heart, what obviously impacted her.
Yeah.
And I sat there and I just went, okay, that's the whole angry God syndrome. Well, they yell at us because they really care about us. He's going like, I don't know. That just hit me sideways, and I just kind of went, there's not something real wonderful about that.
I remember asking Dave Coleman the question. We were talking about some guy that's on TV a lot. I don't see him much anymore, but just a real angry pastor kind of attitude. And from the traditions I've grown up in, and, you know, a lot of Pentecostal churches, some, and, you know, anger is a big part of the rage from the pulpit. You know, it just is often. And I was asking Dave, I said, you know, why is that true? Why is there so much anger? And he said, partly because people who know they're doing wrong during the week feel good after a good beating on Sunday. They just feel good after somebody's really taken them to the woodshed, quote unquote.
Yeah, pastor really gave it to us.
Yeah, and it's like we needed it because we're just bad people, and it somehow sates the conscience. And I thought, wow, what a distorted conscience. And he was saying the same thing. He just said, it's not healthy, but if you feel like you need a good flogging now and then, you're probably not in some wonderful space to grow in.
I mean, I'm looking at little kids and going like, where in the world do we think that somehow – If a child is not performing up to a desired standard or can't quite master a skill we're hoping, why do we somehow think that adding threat and fear and anger to that mix is going to make it better?
That's one of the great mysteries of life. When I did mediations in public school systems, I haven't done a lot of that lately, but when I did, I always was curious as to why do you, and this would hold true, I guess, for our political conflict today in this country. Why do you think increasing levels of obnoxiousness will endear people to your point of view? I mean, it's always the thing that was in my head. Why do you, being a raving, angry lunatic yelling at someone, think you're actually going to persuade them your point of view is better than theirs? And yet it's in that thing.
Oh, well, no, I mean, it's every, I mean, that's why, you know, it's like, I don't have an axe to grind because of this weekend. I just sat there going like, this is a sad commentary that you see played out in a lot of sectors where you're just going like, gosh, why do we think that works? Cause I'm going, you know, to me, when kids know that you believe in them, that you love them and that you're rooting for them, they can do Herculean things that they can't do otherwise if they know you believe in them. Well, I don't – you apply that to, you know, sports skills. You apply that to life. You apply that to doing their homework, you know, behaving morally. I think when people know that someone's rooting for them, gosh, that puts gas in the tank. So why do people turn to the manipulators of fear, threat, and guilt or just – I mean, I just end up going like – I'm pretty sure I'm guilty of that. I'm pretty sure I know I used to do that a lot more. I just go, I don't think it's very effective. You might get short-term change, but you get long-term resentment.
Yeah. And I guess maybe the last team that won the championship maybe had an angry coach. So it's, oh, we all got to be like that then. I don't know. But for young girls like that, how old is Taylor?
She's under 10. This is the under 10 division. Wow. You're just going like, really?
Really?
This is where they still have matching hairdos, and they're just looking to have some serious fun.
Yeah, does he look like he's got an ego set on how well his – well, they won, so it couldn't be that.
He just looked kind of – we just – this was my first tournament watching this dude.
Yep.
You know, practice he seemed fine, but you're just going like, maybe there's an off day, maybe – but – in all of that, you're like, why in the world would you spend time with a whole bunch of under 10 girls if you didn't enjoy spending time and knowing ahead of time this is going to require a lot of patience?
Well, maybe I hear you volunteering to coach the team, Brad.
I'll take over. Just go like, oh.
So what do you do? You're going to complain to the organization? You're going to talk to the coach? Or you have any
idea? We're talking to the coach at the next practice, and then if that doesn't go anywhere, we're talking to the division director and
see where that goes. Wow, sounds like an interesting journey. Well, we had a fabulous weekend.
Fabulous?
Fabulous.
What fabulous weekend did you have?
Oh, we had a live stream board retreat for people on our board and their spouses, and they came down and spent the weekend in our home. And just looking at the crowd on Saturday afternoon, and we did very little meeting and a whole lot of just hanging out, fellowship, and playing frisbee golf, just fooling around. And I look at people. I mean, on this board is a guy that I first met in junior high school and known him.
That's history.
Virtually my whole life, and others. At very significant moments in our journey, they're the people that were there and the people that have loved us and sit and listen to God with us and people you can just relax and share anything with. And I just look across that room because we both had, I think we've had disappointing colleagues in ministry at various times that have turned out to be not what they presented themselves to be. Could we say that? Mm-hmm. And end up turning on you, betraying you, do some horrible thing to you. And I sit there like, here's people who are honest to the core, genuine, deep personal character, but also they have loved us and we have loved them over 40 years of our life and or more. And I just, not all of them, some of them are newer in our life than that, but we had a great time talking about a lot of things going on in our life in the ministry and praying and a lot of things going on in their lives and had a wonderful time just sitting around the breakfast brunch table and shared communion together and talked about our journeys. And I tell you, it was one of those weekends you just come away going, boy, that was so much fun at so many levels. And we loved it. It's cool.
Were they able to give you a sense of perspective?
Always. I don't know that they give it, but our waiting on God together and the things that people were sharing, particularly on Sunday morning, an extended time of just listening to God and praying and sharing. And yeah, and really not so much, here's what we should be doing next, but here's where God is. And here's where our head gets pulled by all the other things that happen sometimes to us. So, yeah.
What do you think the key is for the length of relationship that's been there? Because that's pretty rare.
Well, it's rare in that, and I used to say relationships don't survive long if you share an enterprise together, you know, if you share a ministry or share something. But we have. We've shared this for at least 15 that we've been part of this live stream thing, and not all of them have been on the board that long, but most of them were there in the beginning. And I guess even in the enterprise of what we do, they don't feel personally vested in it. So they're not fighting for their way about anything. And I don't really fight for mine because we don't have to agree at that level about everything we do. I mean, they don't vote on what the next book I'm going to write or the next project I'm going to give my life to, but they basically just hear what we're doing, where we're at, who we're with, and kind of give us commentary about how that looks, how it feels. And it's all done in such a supportive environment. And I think that they are, I think core to long-term friendship is character. It's just you are who you present yourself to be. You're not one thing one day, and then 2, 3 days or weeks or years down the road, you suddenly change into a very different person. And it turns out that during this earlier time, you were presenting a front to get whatever you needed out of others that were there. And I've had that happen to me numerous times. So these are people just, I mean, they love Sarah and me. They love what we're doing. They love looking over my shoulder. And they're not always, you know, supportive in the sense of that they won't say the honest thing to me if I think I need to be pointed to a different direction. But they're supportive in the sense that they're not trying to fight me, take over things, or, you know, whatever. So, and it's just long-term friendship. And we spend a lot of time together not doing business stuff, even when it's not a retreat. But, yeah.
That's probably the key, is enjoying each other.
Yeah, there's friendships that go beyond the work. Yeah, and that's valuable. On another front, we have, for those that have been waiting to wonder how we're doing through all the legal stuff we've been through the last couple of years, it's being announced now that we have reached an out-of-court settlement with Paul Young, and that is a done deal. So,
new chapter in life.
Yeah,
yay!
Allows some new possibilities to open up. It wasn't, people are saying, gosh, was a great finish? Did you get to reconcile all that stuff? You know, there was no opportunity for any kind of relationship stuff to happen. This was all through attorneys, and not my choice, not the way I'd want to deal with these things, but that's how we had to respond.
And we're really not allowed to say much of anything.
Yeah, we're not allowed to talk about the settlement. And so, yeah, and I told Brad coming in that I've really appreciated. We asked you guys, gosh, probably over a year ago, year and a half maybe, that wasn't something we wanted to talk in great detail about, particularly if Paul's not sitting here. And someday we still hope the three of us would be reconciled in a way that would allow us to have an honest conversation about what happened. But we did talk, the three of us, so honestly about the joys of collaboration. And I guess this is the other side. This is the other side of it where people, for whatever reason, decide
not as collaborative.
Feel that, yeah, I've got what I need out of this collaboration, so I'm gone. So
I still believe in collaboration.
I do too.
I still enjoy it.
In fact, we put one to bed last week, a new book that we've collaborated on and collaborated with an artist, a man like no other. I did a blog on it so people could begin to have a look at some of what's in there, but pretty cool. I'm excited about that book coming out, which is going to be when? When might we get these back? Do we have a clue?
I think they'll be available first part of November. At least we'll be able to get it finalized. We're somewhat dependent upon shipping.
Lots of things.
Realities.
But we're hoping for mid-October, are we?
Hoping, but okay. I would sooner promise November
promise later.
And surprise people with earlier.
Hopefully for the Christmas season. I took this book and I got it on my iPad, obviously, a PDF version, and read it to my daughter, my daughter's children, over the time they were with us on a bit of our vacation. And it's not a children's book. We didn't write it for children. It's not aimed at children specifically, but the combination of the art and then reading what I was reading from the thing and Amy's interest in all that was, and I didn't think Lindsay, the 3-year-old, would be all interested, but she kept tagging in there, hanging and looking, and she'd ask a lot of questions. Why was Jesus really a baby? And who was Jesus' father? And we got into a lot of great conversation with little Amy, just looking at that story and the pictures. And I just read the first few to her because they weren't there that long, but she was really engrossed. And every night she comes and says, Grandpa, are we going to read from that book again tonight? So she was really excited about it.
I think kids enjoyed the relationship.
Yeah.
And I think when you have a chance to have material that's at least accessible, or you can make accessible, that's such a thrill.
Yeah. And just, you know, say, is that Jesus's mommy? So, well, no, that's Murray's concept of Jesus's mommy. Obviously, it's not Jesus's mommy.
That is Jesus's mommy right there.
We don't know if that's what she looked like. He painted it from a neighbor girl, but it was someone like that.
It was somebody's neighbor girl.
It was someone like that. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. That's when we traveled around Israel, and they kept saying, we don't know that it happened exactly here, but it happened near here. And we go, okay.
Yeah.
That helps a little bit. Oh.
Well, I still think if one can chase 1,000, two can chase 10,000. And I always appreciate when somebody other than me is able to look at something, and I think my life gets bigger because of it.
Yeah, and I think collaborating on art, and it's difficult in our day. It's difficult with all, even a movie is a huge collaboration of all kinds of people have to come together and do stuff. But that is so protected legally. I always look at that project going, I don't know how anything really, really happens in that environment. But occasionally a good one gets out. So who knows? But no, I'm still very much committed to all that we talked about when we sat here with Paul at other times about the value of collaboration, how God uses it, and why it's a wonderful thing. But I also realize not all collaborations endure.
No.
I'm very aware of that as well. But anyway.
So that chapter is done, and we get to have a new one.
Yeah. Well, we hope it's not done. It's all the legal stuff is done. Who knows where the relationships go up the road, but at least allows us to be done with spending hours and hours on attorney stuff, for which I am grateful.
Have an education is something I never wanted to know.
Yeah.
That's great.
We've had tons of email, blog postings. If you're not reading the blog on the website after listening, you're missing most of the dialogue. We talk about this ever-expanding conversation. It seems the conversation
that's where it's happening.
Has landed on the blog. We particularly the one we talked about a little bit about sovereignty early on and then scripture. We got a ton about that all the way from I'm always amazed at the diversity of our audience, all the way from people who go, man, the Bible's just a piece of junk. Don't read it anymore. Tossed it out. Go on with Jesus, to people that were saying, I still think new scriptures are being written today by people. And I just go, wow.
Oh, wow.
We have a broad spectrum of people out there on how they feel about the scriptures. And yet I noticed, even when you talk about what are those things that help relationships endure, I noticed when we're here with our brothers and sisters over this weekend talking about things and praying together, our common story is the story of scripture. The common things that we can come back to and say, well, didn't Jesus say this? And didn't Paul write that as guideposts to help us discern, are we in the sweet spot of what God's doing, or are we ventured out somewhere on our own? I find people who lose that story, who just think everything's inspired equally with the Bible, or nothing is inspired, including the Bible. I think it really destroys the common story that people talk from and talk about, and that people read and converse from, and illustrations that kind of help me understand what's going on in their life, or them, me, what's going on in mine. And I feel sorry for those that have just either jettisoned it, like, well, it's not a big deal.
Well, it still seems like a reaction.
Yeah. And it was put together by a corrupt church that other agenda's going on anyways. How do we trust the canon? Man, I just go,
by listening to its author.
Yeah, and you look through the course of history, no other books have appeared that says, yeah, that seems like those same other books. I just, you know, they don't. Other books appear from time to time from back then, and you go, boy, it doesn't have that same authenticity about it, and these do. So so we got a lot of that. One guy, you see, I guess we read his letter. I don't remember exactly the nature of his letter, but it was the one that got us kicked about sovereignty. He said, hey, guys, I'm glad you guys took time to read my mail. However, I'm quite disappointed that you guys misconstrued the purpose of my email.
Oops.
Yeah, we're misconstruers at times. That's kind of, we don't intend to do that, but it may happen. I'm not insinuating that humans don't have responsibility regarding the choices they make. I'm saying that in light of God's sovereignty, he works it out to fit into his purpose. Now, if that's how we're defining sovereignty, I'm all good. I didn't hear that in his letter. But I think Issy, and I'm sure that's not his real name, maybe it is, or others that write, sometimes we'll read a letter and it kind of provokes a thought and we're into a longer conversation. We're not talking about you specifically or what you believe, because oftentimes we don't know. Just from an email or a letter, I don't have a clue what you really mean. But we may jump off of that and talk about some of the other people we know kind of push for a sovereignty view that excludes free will. And if you weren't doing that, man, our apologies. That wasn't our plan in using your letter that way. So glad you cleared it up on the blog, though, so other people could see that as well. The inevitable end of religious institutions. Man, we got some people loved it. Said took the red pill long a time ago and loving it. Other people, gosh, not so happy.
No?
No.
Upset with us, are they?
A little bit. And I'm surprised at times, you know, making comments. At least this is one better. People who write me and say, I have never read So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore, but, and then they tell me what would have made it better. I get a few of those.
Oh, that's nice. That's helpful.
This is from a guy who says he's speechless and dumbfounded. He says, first time I've listened to one of the God Journey podcasts, I have to admit to being completely taken aback, if not outright shocked, at the degree to which Wayne and Brad mock and ridicule the unfortunate multitudes for their mistaken beliefs. In my book, I don't know what book that is. In my book, such conduct belies.
When did we do that?
What the principles claim to stand for. How is Christ like that? The more substantive logical content is a lot more beneficial, but taken all together, is that really intended to encourage repentance and getting aligned with God and His creation? And I'd say, well, first of all, we were not intending that. But it comes across to me a lot more like patting ourselves on the back for figuring it out, making it, and shouting losers to the rest of the poor, ignorant, misguided slobs who are still wandering helplessly and blindly around the desert. Give it a listen and ask
yourself. Is that a direct quote?
No, none of that is. That's a direct quote of his letter. Give it a listen and ask yourselves what's really how we want to come across to people who supposedly want to be helping. I wish I hadn't heard it. That's from Speechless and Dumbfounded. He wasn't speechless, though.
Our apologies if that's the way it came across. I'm pretty sure it didn't, but it did to him.
I had a lot of people write after that saying, you know, I re-listened to it to get what you said, and I think Wayne and Brad were being very generous to those. Because I think what you may misunderstand, we got another letter that compared what we were saying to, like, well, if you're having trouble parenting, kick your kids out of your house, which is
what
how they saw taking the red pill, I guess. That was interesting. But, you know, I think, first of all, you don't listen a lot. You don't maybe know where we're coming from. And you could misinterpret it. And I don't know how you came on the podcast anyway, how you came up on it. But I, for one, I don't believe people in the system are quote-unquote losers. And I don't think every Sunday morning event is a system, in the same way of a religious system that's harming people.
Right.
I think what we're responding to in the note was, if the inevitability of the religious systems we have tends its leaders toward arrogance and unintreatability and whatever else that was in the podcast.
Serious issues.
Yeah, then and I think it does. I think at its ongoing larger scale, particularly guys that are trying to climb that ladder of church growth, I do think there's an inevitable reality to that, which is what we were responding to. If you're like this guy, it feels like it may not necessarily be inevitable. It's just guys that are struggling inside the temptations, and we should be praying for them that they won't be sucked into that. I'm not angry about that view. I wouldn't call those guys losers. I think we've said, even in the podcast, we have a lot of compassion for people that are in those places and still struggling with those things and trying to sort out their part of the journey. And we came from there. We got our love for Jesus there. We got a lot of our passions from those things.
Yeah, I'd have to say that most of the... If there is any mockery, I mean, I think we talked about the mockometer.
That was last week, though. And we haven't used it much.
No, we haven't used it for a while. I think most of it is sort of self-directed in terms of a way, while being sort of in the institution and sort of having to play along to some degree, what that forces you to embrace or think and the struggle there. I mean, I look at the difficulty is, I don't think the problem is so much, you know, here's the losers, here's the winners, but you get forced and conformed into a system of thought, and it does seem very contrary at times to the way Jesus functioned. And I looked at the how did the industrialization of people's discipleship, and I'm going, you know what? I don't see Jesus doing that. He seems to treat the individual as far more important than the mass. And yet, as someone who is taxed with the chore of administrating a large gathering of people, I found those things at odds. And I'm going like, well, what are we doing? If Jesus had similar challenges, but he had a different value system, why is the success of the one I'm doing seemingly on a different page? That's what I realized. I think something's wrong here.
Yeah, that's why we're not there. We're not there because, well, we just didn't want to play in that playground. I came to the conclusion that what you have to do to motivate people to keep an institution of any size efficient and working well is at odds with what love would do to help people live in freedom and know the fullness of the life of God. Now, not every, particularly smaller congregations, not every congregation does that. I agree with that. That's not a blanket condemnation of them all. There are some people that very much are trying to learn to live loved, and whoever's in leadership, they're collegial about it, and they're trying to find ways to help people genuinely grow. I'm all for that kind of thing, but I just think the reality is there's a current that tends toward this other direction. To have somebody from Christianity Today say it so clearly was what we thought was hilarious, and if that hilarity was taken as mocking, I don't think that was in our hearts, and I've seen enough other people kind of post saying I didn't think it was either, but...
Don't you think to some degree, I don't know, I mean, I could raise my hand as guilty as charged. I think at times we listen according to the filter that's in our heart.
How can we not?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think that makes real, true communication a challenge, because I have to be aware of my bias so as to be able to filter it out. You know, if I'm not, then I'm going to hear things that are said that may not be meant the way I'm hearing them. But I'm hearing them according to that filter that's inside, and then I might be reacting according to that. And I think that's just one of the biggest challenges in terms of communication. And when you see, two different camps, it just so oftentimes sees that they're not really talking to each other. They're arguing with each other's idea of each other or caricature. And it typically is not a real positive one.
Oh, that's a lost cause, isn't it? If I'm having to dialogue with you about your perception of me, which is different than my perception of me,
it just goes down the wrong hole.
There's no way to get to a good fix there.
No. And I think one of the biggest challenges, especially like, you just added religion and politics, whatever, is to be able to realize all of us have that. I don't think there's a person on the planet that doesn't have a biased filter that causes them to hear things perhaps a little different than what they're necessarily said.
Yep.
And I think when you recognize that, and then your desires, hey, how do I value this person? I think that leads to better conversations, as opposed to how do I prove the conclusion I already have? or how do I, win someone to my way of thinking? It's like when you're doing that, you're probably not really listening. And I don't think it gets anywhere.
Oh, it never gets anywhere. It goes downhill. And the same thing is true of trying to find that conversation that brings life. A presentation like we do on a podcast, people hear it, you hear one of them, you make assumptions about what we know and believe. If you're in a conversation, somebody's saying, hold it a minute. Are you saying this? And then when you say, no, gosh, no, I'm not saying that. And here's why I wouldn't be saying that. And then if they turn around and say, no, I think you were saying that. Then I think it's over.
Yeah, you're no longer looking to relate. You're looking to prove.
Yeah, if you can't take people at face value, and if you can't trust, because we don't see, we've talked about this tons, you really don't know the motives of another person. And when you think you do, and I think that's the easiest way to vilify somebody. I know that you're this way. And once I know that, even if you're saying, gosh, I'm not perfect, I'm flawed, surely, but there's stuff in my heart, I want God to show it to me. But no, it isn't really why I said those things. And if that's, well, I think it is. I've learned in the past, the conversation is over. Might as well just move on to something else. Yeah. So, sorry about that for those who took offense, but we were just trying to really talk about the fact that someone who takes a look at it from the inside of that system says this is the inevitable end of our is arrogance and whatever, whatever. And I think the reason we resonate with that, because we think it's true. I think it's by and large true.
Yeah, you know, I think that I heard someone share a dream about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago about the way in which men relate to God. And it's like they were saying it from a non-denominational platform at the time, as if, wouldn't it be great if we could respond to the movements of God without creating them, without institutionalizing them? And when I, well, that was so killer to me when I first heard it. It's like, oh yeah, that would be great. And then I saw the inevitable reality is the very guy who said that, his whole life-giving deal became one of those. And then the justification of that came. And I just sat there going like, okay, golly, as someone who was responding to the genuineness of what was being said on the front end, going like, yeah, wouldn't that be great if we didn't always set up our monuments and we didn't have our need to declare, well, who was responsible for this and all that other stuff. It's like if we could just continually be fluid and respond to what God's doing. And when it needs to be organized, organize it. And when it doesn't, we sort of let that go. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, it would be. If we thought more in terms of tasks instead of ministries, because ministries have a sense of permanence and movement and getting market share and, you know, advancing all that, paying expenses. And tasks just are, we just did what God asked us to do and it's done. And we didn't have to create anything out of that that had to be enduring.
I think that would help.
It would help.
And it's just, I still have a longing in my heart to say, Lord, you're doing something, and you're doing it with a lot of people, and I would love to see those jointly tasked together respond and do what you've asked us to do, and then somehow be free at that moment to then go, okay, what now? As opposed to all the assumptions that you pack into when we've organized it. Well, God didn't necessarily ask that. No, but that's what we did. And then now you got to justify that. And it's like, golly, that's where I think there's a lot of breakdown that doesn't allow us to continue to respond to what God might be doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've inherited. We've sort of inherited all the stuff that's been organized. And then we didn't hear the first speech. We got the justification of the second one. And so it's like, well, that's what we're supposed to be doing. That's what it is to be the people of God, the body. And I'm just going like, I thought we were the people of the cloud. I mean, I thought that's where this story sort of began.
That people of the cloud?
In the Old Testament, when they were getting out of Egypt.
Yep. I knew what you were talking about. I didn't know if other people knew.
Okay.
I thought you were talking about the iCloud and putting
it on. Yeah, no, yeah. Do your storage up there. It's wonderful megabytes. No, the reality is what I always got fascinated with is the sense of journey of going, you know, God didn't seem to tell anybody the whole triptych. He gave them what they needed to know to get to where he wanted to bring them, but he always kept them somewhat in a place of purposeful dependence because the point was relationship. And I think that we find that hard, therefore, no, give me the principles. I would like to just, I'm going to flip ahead to the end of the chapter, and I'm going to mark out the journey the way I see it. And then it's like, what you've lost there is the purposeful sense of dependence. Because he isn't looking for us to do this under our own strength, but I think we do.
Yeah.
And I don't know why we prefer that. I mean, it's like, I'm a very capable person. But I have looked back and I have really enjoyed when God has done stuff that I'm going like, I cannot lay claim to. There's a joy in that for me that I'm just going like, oh, he was a part of this.
Yeah, it's as if the direction becomes the destination because we don't keep listening. And so the last thing we heard put us here. And if you're going to lead somebody on a trail, you might say, you know, head toward this. And then we get there, you're going to turn left and go whatever. And when you stop listening, if God really is, and I think he what he most wants is to grow in our growing trust in who he is and growing to listen. So he doesn't give us a roadmap, the triptych, as you call it. He gives us, I want you to go this way. And then we go that way. And if we stop listening, we that's the only direction we have. We're just going to keep going this way. And then we're going to build a movement out of this way. And this is what one of my board members said this week, and I thought it was so interesting. When you lose the sense that God's caring for you, then you have to fight for what's yours. And fighting for what's yours is really the opposite of the way God works in the world. And it really is true that when you lose sense of God's the one caring for me, God's the one leading me, God's the active voice in my life, then you want to make an institution out of something. Just like if God, when Sarah and I go hiking, we may join up with some other people, and for a while they may be going the same way we're going, and then we come to a point where we don't. And there's the freedom in the journey to walk alongside somebody for a time without having to own. And what we tend to do is own. We tend to possess and make things, and then we got to possess or protect them, and then we fight over them, and then we've lost the sense that this is just a journey. That was a moment. That was something God gave. It was lovely. But now let's move on to the things that God has and not get stuck at whatever spot we last heard him.
It's uncomfortable to live in such a way that when God just lifts, you're supposed to move. Don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, just think, you got a big camping expedition, couple million people in a desert. Got to huddle close to the fire at night and got to watch the cloud during the day. And sometimes it stays put, and it didn't tell me why. And then there was a group of people just assigned to watch the cloud. And as soon as the cloud moved, they blow the trumpets. Everyone else is supposed to pack up. That's a difficult way to live life. Don't you think?
Why I'm hesitating with that is because in my flesh, all over that, yes, very incredibly difficult. There's a part of me now that really doesn't want to live any other way.
No, I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. But why is that? Why do you not want to live any other way? Because I think for most people, that kind of insecurity, they don't see that as stability. They don't see that as security. They see that as, well, how do I then plan? How do I then, you know, what if I'm in the middle of something? So why do you... Who can understand, gee, my flesh gets that, I don't like that. Why do you say, no, but I don't want to live another way? Well, what's the missing part of the other set of equations here?
Well, I think that just fails you. I think everything I've put my certainty in has failed me. So it's like, do I want to go down that road again? It's like I've been down that road, it fall off a cliff 10 different times. Do I want to really go down that road again? I you know, people get some of the letters we got, you know, offended by religion, and I got out of religion. I took the red pill a long time ago, and it's easy to go, yeah, I'm sick of what religion is, and I'm going to go out and be like Jesus and be different and be whatever. And then you get out there and you realize that the reason we have religious movements, institutions, organizations is because they do provide a security for people. And it may be a, you know, blanket suck my thumb kind of, which I know people are mocking you, saying we're all losers, our babies. Or I just think, I think those are false comforts. That's what I mean by that. What I've learned now is I'd rather be continuing to live in the next voice. And I get the email all the time and the conversations I have as I travel around. People who go on this journey and find out, gosh, their answers weren't in religion. There's a moment where you get really frustrated that things don't seem as secure as they used to seem. Things are not certain. And the next thing is, yeah, can you become comfortable in that uncertainty? Because that's where you'll find life. That's where you'll continue to find a drawing to God and finding my certainty in him, not my certainty in the next plan I have or the next step I have or the machine I want to create or whatever it is. And I think everyone who goes on this journey, that is one of those detoxing periods. It's brutal. And often the only way we learn it is like I learned it. All the things I could contrive on my own eventually failed me. Not that I couldn't make it better for a moment. It just looked good and I could feel better and I could justify it with other people. I could. But in the end, it didn't enhance my relationship. And that's what I mean by not getting me there. It's not that I couldn't even be successful doing things like that. But it didn't answer the deeper cry of my heart, which is I want to know him and I want to follow him. And I want to be tomorrow waking up and saying, and I used this weekend with some folks, that the expression, I used to like West Wing. Great series, mm-hmm. I thought, enjoyed it. One of the things that I loved out of that was they'd be involved in this intense debate over this political thing, and all of a sudden the president stopped and say, okay, what's next? And I was like, done with that, what's ahead? And I found God resonating that in my heart a lot with, okay, that's done. God, what's next? And really being comfortable and excited about what's next, even if I don't have a clue what next is. That's where I find great joy. So that's why I'm saying, yeah, my flesh gets all over. Build me a tent, give me a security plant right here. This last thing God told me, I'm going to make a machine out of this till the day I die. But then there's this other intuitive, insightful, spiritual, whatever side of me that says, ooh, yuck. I do not want to camp someplace that God was only intending to lead me through and not establish a beachhead there for me to build a house. And that being sojourners, that language, that's why I love the God journey. I just, that language of scripture is whenever we plant tent stakes and start to build a place for ourselves, it's where we're generally going to start trusting in us instead of trusting in him, or trusting in me. So,
yeah, I think for me,
did you find something similar? Is that?
Yeah, I think for me in that whole dynamic, I recognized, you know, a desire to plan, to sort of do things, is to sort of go like, okay, how do I, you know, if this is what he said, well, then this is what I do. I do think it, you have to come to an end to realize, gosh, I'm not so sure we're great at filling in the rest of that equation.
Oh,
I think we need his voice to do that as well. It's not that we're not creative, and it's not that we can't come up with 1,001 things.
Or even ingenious. I got great wisdom to do this.
But I think the one fundamental difference for me that says, you know, I want to be a person of the cloud, the following his presence, is I don't like doing this without a genuine dialogue. And I don't want to give the false impression that, well, I wake up and Jesus is already up and we sit down and have breakfast and he says, well, hello, Brad, you know, how'd you sleep? Here's how it goes today. Yeah. I don't want to give that,
right.
But I do know what it is to have a sense of dialogue about what I'm doing and when that's not there. And I don't like life when it's not there. For me, the idea of trying to camp out and build out camp when there isn't an ongoing sense of dialogue, that's when I feel insecure. That's when I'm going like, I don't want to do that. And it's more just either his voice is active and continuing to guide, or if I've lost that sense of it, that's when I start to go like, where's the cloud? Did it move? Did I not see it? Did the trumpet blow and yeah. I missed it? Because to me, security really is found in that place of knowing I'm in the dialogue. And it's not moment to moment, hey, turn left. But right. There are moments where it is turn left. I don't feel like I control that, but I do know that I'm engaged in that. And when I am, that's where I get my security. And then it's like, well, if you need to move, great. My attitude is, if I need to move, I want to move. That's the safer place to be, as opposed to, well, I liked it here. I don't like it here if he's not a part of that. Yeah. I think that's what's really changed inside of me in terms of going, this whole thing is only about relationship. It is not about achievement of some religious end apart from him.
And that's even part of the uncertainty is we know in part, we see, look through a glass darkly. It's you kind of muddle into the reality of what God's revealing to you. But I'm like you. I notice when that process is stopped and it's stagnant and I'm kind of muddling along, but now it's just me muddling along. I definitely want to muddle along with him and little markers of things God puts in people, whatever, saying things that go, oh, yeah, that's where I'm at. That's where I want to live. That's where I want to go. And I think people who are uncomfortable with uncertainty are going to find the God journey incredibly difficult. And I think God even, you know, God puts himself in a tabernacle, a tent, to travel with the people. So they had a sense he was there. Because if he was up there in the cloud, it was too scary for them. They didn't want anything to do with that. So I'll pretend I'm in this holy of holy place here. But now we know God was no more present there than he was present everywhere else. It just gave them a place they could have him with them and feel safe. And then they want to build him a temple. You know, David does. Solomon finally builds it. I want to build God something more permanent. Well, God didn't even want the temporary part of it. And then we do such incredible things for God that turn out to work against the very thing our hearts long the deepest for. And that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, this is a longer story, but the punchline is pretty quick. When we were in Jerusalem, walking around little holy city stuff, it felt like such a turf war. Everybody had their building, and everyone was fighting for their deal.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, it didn't feel all that wonderful and peaceful. It different sectors had a different spiritual feel, a different, but they all kind of like, eh. The place that I ended up feeling the most comfortable and ended up for a couple hours talking to this like Bedouin gypsy guy was the one guy that had a passion for God, but didn't have a building in the game. And he had all these keys to all, I mean, it was, to me, it was this little prophetic picture of, you know what? This guy's on a journey. The place that I felt most comfortable in all of that little environs was the one guy that didn't have a permanent stake in the game, but more lived as that journeyman, a traveler, someone who was moving through and focused on something else.
Well, it seems like once we live with something to possess or something to protect, it just goes awry.
Yeah.
Thank you for traveling with us on The God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.